Imagine going to the doctor and being told you're 60% healthy. Would you be satisfied that that one number adequately encapsulated all aspects of your health? Now think about the ocean. The world's oceans are home to half of all life on Earth and provide half the oxygen in the atmosphere. Fishing is an important source of both food and jobs worldwide. The ocean also drives global weather patterns and makes global trade economically feasible. But the benefits we derive from the ocean often come at a trade-off. A team of ocean scientists recently rated global ocean health a 60 out of 100. Scott Doney is a senior scientist at the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He's one of the approximately three dozen scientists who helped calculate the newly released Ocean Health Index, and he joins us to talk about ocean health. Welcome, Scott.
Good morning, Heather.
So I have to say, I find the whole idea of a single number ocean health index completely mind-boggling. The ocean is so immense, and our relationship with it is so immensely complex. One of your colleagues on the project, Ben Halpern, has said that the idea of an ocean health index is audacious but necessary. What does that mean? Why is this necessary?
Well, you could make the same argument for the economy, but we look at the global domestic product, the GDP. And certainly that it's one measure. And what we were trying to come up with was a measure that we could then look at how things are changing over time and try to use that to allow people to understand what the current state of the ocean is, but also as we start to improve our behavior towards the ocean, that we could actually track that with time. And yes, any single number is going to be a simplification. But if we handed you 1,000 numbers, would that be more helpful than a single number?
Probably not. That would probably be a little overwhelming, I guess. Where did this idea come from? Whose idea was it? How did it get started?
To be honest, I'm not actually sure if there was any single point in time where somebody said, aha, let's do this. This has been, at least when I've been involved, it's been a discussion over several years. And it was also a long discussion as to how we'd actually create it. What would be an ocean health index? How would it differ from other efforts to try to quantify the state of the ocean?
So what other kinds of efforts have there been in that regard?
Well, there's a lot of local efforts to look at, say, local pollution or look at loss of species in a particular area. There's certainly been lots of effort to look at the health of fisheries. What we wanted to do was to try to pull together all these different strands and look at all the different ways that people interact with the sea and put it into a single number.
I'm talking with Scott Doney of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about a newly released Ocean Health Index. If you have questions or comments, you can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. We're also on Twitter at livinglabradio. So you're trying to do this enormous thing of taking, as you said, not just water quality or fishing or any of these one things, but try to take them all and turn them into just one, essentially boil it all down into one number. So how did you go about getting that process started? Who was involved and what kind of expertise and data did they bring to the table?
So this was an effort that combined folks like myself, academic researchers, people working at environmental and conservation groups. The New England Aquarium is involved, the National Geographic Society. And a lot of this started as brainstorming, basically 20 of us either sitting on the phone or sitting in a room and trying to talk through all the different ways that we thought things that we wanted to quantify. And so the initial blackboard looked a lot like this 1,000 numbers that I was telling you about. And then we tried to group things together and try to put it into a framework. And that's how we came up with this idea of looking at 10 what we call public goods, public goals, at things like food provision, jobs and livelihoods, coastal protection, biodiversity. So some of them are things that you can think of as harvesting from the ocean, things we get from the ocean like natural products or food, both wild harvest and aquaculture. Some are things that are more difficult to quantify, but it's, for example, sense of place was the idea that people get a benefit by just knowing that there's these beautiful places in the ocean that are undisturbed. There are species like polar bears or sea otters or whales that we place value in their existence, even if we don't directly go out and either look at them or get a direct benefit from them. So some of these are things that you could put economic dollar values on, like jobs or tourism, and others were benefits that are harder to quantify. And of course, that was a real challenge as we were building the index of how do you mix and match. You know, it's not just apples and oranges, but it's apples and books and China and, you know, all put together into a single index.
How subjective would you say the index is when you come down to it? I mean, because you're trying to put a number on something like sense of place, right, and essentially, you know, give it a 0 to 100 kind of number. And I mean, what is 100%? What is that benchmark, right, and how do you rate within that? So how subjective does this end up being in the end?
Well, the way we were trying to do it for each of these goals was we had to have some reference. And for some of the goals, it's very clear. For example, in all these goals, we were trying to find and give higher scores for what we call sustainable behavior. So you couldn't go out, for example, under the food provision or the fishing. You know, fishing everything out in a single year was not going to give you a high score. It was, could you, and this is something we're working towards in the United States, is sustainable fishing. You know, fishing at a level that provides a lot of economic benefit, particularly to the local communities, but also is sustainable over basically an extended period of time. For each of the goals, we had to lay down what we call the reference. What would be 100 in this case? And in some cases, that's, you know, for fishing, we have a pretty good set of models. For other things, we had to say, well, we'll take a particular period of time and say that was the reference point. And if things have gotten better than that, we'll give a higher score. So in theory, you could get more than 100. You could get extra credit. And if things have degraded with time, you'd get a lower score. And so I look at the scores. The numbers are useful, but primarily they're useful as laying down what the trends will be with time. You know, think about the stock market. You know, we all look at the Dow Jones Index number. Very few people know exactly what it means. I don't. But is it higher than it was last year? Is it lower? So it's really looking at trends over time that I think is the real value of this index.
So it's really interesting when you do look at those 10 categories that you guys chose to evaluate. From the name of it, I mean, you call it an ocean health index. It seems very ocean-centric, and you might think, okay, well, it would be, sure, clean water and biodiversity certainly fits into that, but you might be expecting, or at least I was expecting, kind of looking at it, very ecosystem-based categories. And instead, what you get are very human-based. It's a very human-centric index of ocean health, and that was obviously on purpose, but I wonder why you chose to go that route. Was it to make it more accessible, or do you think that's kind of inherently the best metric of ocean health?
This certainly was a lot of discussion, and I think this is one of the novel aspects of this work, is we are looking at it. You say human-centric. We actually talk about it as a coupled system, that you can't separate people's activities, particularly from the coastal ocean, anymore. You know, between fishing and recreation and tourism and shipping and all the things that we do on the ocean, it's not just a natural system anymore. And part of it was to get people to get out of the mold of thinking that, a pristine ocean is the only perfect ocean and that any use is bad. We certainly don't think of that on the land. You know, we farm the land, we manage forests. We're trying to come up with sustainable ways of using the land. And it's the same for the ocean. We need the ocean, but we need to come up with sustainable ways of managing the ocean over time. And trying to break down that dichotomy of, you know, environmentalists on one side and people who use the ocean on the other side.
So I wonder if we could walk through, pick maybe one of these categories and kind of walk through the process of selecting data and trying to turn it into a number for one of these 10 categories.
Right. So there are several categories that I was fairly closely involved with. One is what's called coastal protection. And this is the idea. It's very relevant given Irene and the storms that just hit the Gulf.
Absolutely.
Is that the natural wetlands actually protect coastal communities by providing a buffer zone for storm surge. They also provide a whole variety of other services. And so we looked at the data on things like mangroves, coral reefs, seagrasses, wetlands, and tried to track those over time to see if the amount of those wetlands that buffer and protect coastal communities was going up or down. And we did it at the level of countries. So this first exercise was a global exercise, but we broke it down into 171 different countries and territories. So we collected data on all those different habitats and how they've been changing on time for each of those countries.
Sorry to interrupt. You say collected data, but you guys didn't actually go out
in the field.
So how much data for the entire globe? There have got to be places where there essentially wasn't any data.
Right. And where there's no data, we didn't obviously fold that into the index. But there's been a surprising effort at the international scientific level of trying to collate data. We had, and I should say the real heart of this work was done by a group of graduate students and postdoctoral investigators out at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The scientists sat around with whiteboards and came up with great ideas. And then the students would work diligently all hours of the day trying to track down data sets, either in the literature or, you know, contacting colleagues. And then we would pull it together and then take a look at these different data sets. So, yeah, by collecting, it was a synthesis activity. So there were a couple of different components. So we started with, you know, how much wetland is there now? Has there been a trend with time? Are things degrading with time? And then we also looked at both what we called pressures and resilience. So pressures would be things like climate change and sea level rise that are threatening a lot of wetlands, ocean acidification that might be, say, threatening coral reefs, pollution. There were a whole series of different pressures that we looked at for each specific habitat. And then we also looked at things that, as I said, resilience, things that would make you think that the system might be getting better in the future. And some of this was the ability of individual governments to manage effectively their local resources. Did they have laws in place to manage their coastal environment? Had they signed on to international treaties to protect habitats or species, endangered species? And we tried to then combine that all and, as you say, put it all into the blender and come up with a single number. But we weighted it so that for every country, it was consistent. And we tried to use, for this exercise, global data sets so that at least there was some comparability between numbers in, say, Australia and Costa Rica and the United States and Japan, which is tough. And that did limit the type of data that we could use.
I mean, you're saying in this case that, you know, you weighted things differently to try to get the most accurate number. I know in the case of the clean water category, you made the interesting decision, you know, not all of these numbers are just an average, or that in the case of clean water, it was kind of a weakest link argument that the clean water score was only as good as the worst,
right,
worst score within all of the different kinds of pollution that you could possibly imagine.
Well, the argument for clean waters is if it's really dirty for one thing, whether it's bacteria or organic solvents or, you know, excess nutrients, you're not going to be able to use it. If you can't swim in it and you can't fish in it and you can't harvest out of it because it's dirty for one thing, it really doesn't matter that it's pristine for five other types of chemicals. So there we were trying to look at it as how you would actually use the water. If there's a sign that says no swimming, do you really care exactly what the cause of the no swimming is? You still can't swim there.
But then when you get to the stage of combining these 10 categories into one number for any one location, that is then an average. So even if your water is unswimmably dirty, say, you know, that's one of 10 categories, you're not going to fail and get a score of whatever, 5 out of 100
right,
for everything. That then does...
Right. we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to weight these 10 categories. We even did, we brought in for a couple of different regions stakeholders and had them discuss, you know, how they would weight clean water versus, you know, fishing versus coastal protection. And we went through the exercise of looking at it through different lenses. You know, maybe somebody's more interested in the economic value and the things you can extract from the ocean. Another person might be more of, I think we use the phrase preservationist. And then they would weight things like sense of place or biodiversity higher than food provision. So we did go through that exercise, and we found that when we use these different weightings, these different perspectives, you did get different numbers, but the overall picture of the tropical coastal nations being the ones under the most stress, having the worst health of the oceans, still came out, even if we looked at these different perspectives. And I think that was one of the really interesting things when you look across the globe, the places, the less developed countries that don't have a lot of regulations in place, don't have pollution controls, aren't managing their fisheries well, didn't score well. But the idea is that perhaps we can then use this information and help people in those, you know, governments, NGOs, scientists in those countries, provide them the information so they can use this as a baseline for improvements in the future.
So on a global scale, when you put all those different countries and all the different categories together, came out to a score of 60. And you've told me this is not a 60%. It's not, you know, that the ocean's got a C minus or a D or whatever a 60 would translate to in high school. What is the difference in your mind between a grade and an index? How good or bad is this 60 out of 100?
Yeah, if my son came home with a 60 on an exam, that would be the end of life as he knows it. What we were trying to do was come up with, yes, everyone wants to put it a grade. I really think there are problems. That was one of the things when you put all this data together. And I should say that, you know, there are, I think we had 101 different data layers, different types of data that we're all feeding into this. There certainly are problems, and no country is immune to that. There are low scores, low subscores within all the countries. So it should be highlight for people that there's a ways to go for there are improvements we can make to the ocean, the way we manage the ocean. I wouldn't think of it as a grade. I think of it as a place to start and really thinking. One of the exercises we're trying to go through now is do the same activity but on a smaller scale. So on a regional scale within different countries. And there we'll have richer data sets, and there we'll actually be able to provide information at the level that can really help resource managers. So at the level of individual states or groups of states, rather than at a national level, which can often be very daunting.
So you mentioned that the tropical nations often are fall at the bottom of the rankings here. The top five actually was really interesting to me. The five nations or regions that ranked the best, the United States is not among them. We'll say that right off. The United States ranks around 26th. But the top three are, perhaps not surprisingly, uninhabited islands, essentially. So they don't face the pressures of coastal development, of fishing, of tourism, or of any of that.
I view the uninhabited islands as being somewhat of a separate category. We still computed all the indexes, but as you say, they're uninhabited. So at the same time, they don't have the same pressures. We also didn't look at them to be provisioning food, for example, because they're uninhabited. So they only got scores on the subset of these goals that were relevant to their situation. I think the more relevant ones are looking at countries that are trying to deal with all the trade-offs and interactions between people wanting to, you know, all the different uses that we use the sea for. And one of the things that we're hoping to get out of this index, and this is where a lot of the research is going, is what are the trade-offs between, you know, sustainable fishing and, you know, using the ocean for tourism and recreation and livelihoods and jobs. And sometimes those are framed as truly opposites. You know, we can't sustain biodiversity and fish at the same time. We can't do this and this. And one of the things we're trying to do by looking at the data is see, is that really true? Is that just perception? And if it is true, how can we develop management schemes and ways of managing the ocean that would reduce those trade-offs so that we can get the most benefit out of the ocean?
Well, so the top three, the absolute top three were uninhabited, but numbers four and five were the Seychelles, which is a very small island nation off the east coast of Africa, and Germany. So, I mean, two very different places in very different stages of economic development, of population, of all sorts of things. Are there some lessons that we can learn from those two different places?
So some of the reasons why the Seychelles scored well is they have a very vibrant tourism and recreation, at least with the way we calculated tourism and recreation at the global level of using the coastal ocean. And they actually depend quite a bit on and get a lot of benefit for their local economy from that. There hasn't been a lot of degradation of their coral reefs there relative to some other places. So they sort of scored well for that. And if I'd have to go back and look at all the numbers, but I think they did well on some of these resilience issues related to governance. And so we were thinking that their management pathway was, based on the data, was fairly positive. Germany, a different balance of things, but high scores on coastal protection and habitat protection, reasonably high scores on fishery and food provision. And so I think that's, you know, these are like these little nested Russian dolls. The data sets, you open up, you look at one thing, and it's like, well, why did Germany score well? Well, let's look at all these different things, and you can kind of dig down through the data. And that's one of the things we've put the data online. I think Scientific American has put a web-based interface that you can play with the numbers. So anybody out there can go over there and play with the numbers and look at their favorite place or their favorite goal and really get a sense for how we're doing on those things.
So let's talk about the United States for a couple of minutes. As we said, it ranked 26th. It got a score of 63. Most of the scores, actually, when you went through the 10 categories, were in kind of the 70s or 80s, so not too bad. But there were a couple of really interesting dichotomies. I mean, we got a 97% for coastal livelihood and economies. So doing great on having coastal communities with coastal ocean-dependent jobs, but only a 1% for tourism and recreation. Right. What is that about?
This is where we had a real lack of data for the globe. There's a lot of data about tourism and recreation within the U.S. and coastal tourism. Basically, we're trying to pinpoint tourism that's driven by having a healthy ocean. And I'd say this is one of the categories that we didn't have as good a data as we wanted at the international level. And so we were comparing things, basically looking at the only data set we had at the time, which was international tourism travel, and then we normalized it by coastline. And so the United States doesn't score well there. That's certainly a failing that we understand about the index. And I'd say this is a lot like other products. We, you know, in the first incarnation, there's going to be some blemishes and warts. And as we get better data sets, part of the idea of this is to get people to collect data in a different way that could then be synthesized. And the plan is that as we move forward in time, not only would we look at how things are changing with time, as we got better data sets where we can, we would go back and reevaluate what the trends have been over time with new and improved data sets.
So are there concrete plans to update the Ocean Health Index on a regular basis?
There are plans by some of the So some of the environmental groups that are involved in this, Conservation International is one of them, I think certainly have plans in the future. I think a lot of the scientists are going to be using this more, you know, going in research directions, and that this the environmental groups would be trying to maintain this over time, and that the connection would be as we got new ideas on how to analyze the data or new data sets, we would feed that, you know, there'd be a two-way interaction between the two groups.
So obviously this was intended for public use, for use by policymakers and managers.
But not just policymakers and managers. I think it's really important for the general public to really have a sense for what the state of the ocean is. One of the things I really look forward to is we've got a couple of projects where we're trying to do this at a more regional and local level that would really connect more closely with people's lives.
I mean, so it they seems like the Cape and Islands would be a great place to work on this tourism index. Obviously, we have a lot of tourism based on a healthy ocean. So are there more, do you know of examples where policymakers, though, or governments are really looking to try to use this index in a new way?
I don't have all the details, but I've gotten emails from various co-authors that we've already been approached by. Our group as a whole has been approached by several countries and also several states, saying, "Wow, this was a really interesting exercise. Could we do this? Could you help us do this at a regional level? We really want to know how we're doing at a more detailed level than what we could do for this first exercise at the globe." And I think that's the most important thing is, in the end, you know, independent of what the specific index value is, are you collecting the right data, and are people looking at it? And are people looking at how can we improve the state of the ocean over time?
Scott Doney is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a member of the team that calculated the newly released Ocean Health Index. Thanks for joining us this morning, Scott.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can find links to more information about the Ocean Health Index on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.